Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. It is Ancient History Day, and of course, I am very, very excited, as always, because today we have with us Peter Stoppard, who is an author, journalist, and historian. He writes primarily on ancient history, and he's with us today to talk about his brand new book, The Last Assassin. And I hope you guys know what this is about, The Last Assassin. Peter, welcome.
Welcome to you, welcome to me, great to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about this because we always touch on this event on various different subjects of ancient history that we do, or for example, when we do Down the Pub, we always touch on it, but we never actually talk about it and we don't talk about the consequences. So what we're talking about today is the assassination of, are you all ready? Dun dun dun, Caesar. First of all, can you give us a brief overview of the situation in Rome under the dictator Caesar?
Well, having a dictator was not an attractive thing for a lot of the posh guys in Rome. The guys who were used to ruling Rome and sharing power amongst themselves suddenly found that not only did they had a dictator, but they'd had dictators in emergencies before, but they had a dictator who was going to be a dictator for life. And that essentially meant that all the good jobs in the provinces, all the things you can make money out of, all the sort of power you could have and influence and being a big guy in Rome, suddenly was all in the hands of one guy. And he handed it out the jobs to his friends or sometimes to his enemies or people he wanted to kind of pardon or to be nice to. But it didn't make any difference because everything was controlled by him. And so people thought, This is new. We don't like this. And maybe even he wants to continue that. Maybe he wants to turn himself into a king or a kind of hereditary autocrat of some sort or another. So a lot of people who had used to having power themselves or their families having power found that their chances were suddenly all dependent on Caesar. And they started getting together and deciding that they didn't like that and what they might do about it.
I find this a little bit ironic, really, because not long after Caesar's death, you do more or less get a king, aka Augustus. So I just find it quite amusing that that's the sequence of events.
Yeah, well, that was the terrible irony about it for the assassin, and only the assassin who lasted right to the end. The guy I've been writing about called Cassius Parmensis, who managed to survive for 14 years after the assassination. He was the only one who saw that all the sort of high-flown chat that they'd had before the assassination about, you know, is it right to kill a tyrant? You know, is it, what are the pros and cons? You know, is it better getting liberty better than avoiding civil war, if you like. All those quite high-flown arguments about how you should conduct yourself all sort of turned to nothing over the last 14 years because you actually got, at the end, an autocrat, more autocratic, you know, more single, more of the power of a single man than there's any evidence that Caesar would ever have done himself. So it's a good example of how you can do something for what you think is the right reasons, but it can have consequences very different from the ones that you hope for.
So then Caesar gets too big for his boots. He gets assassinated. We all know why he's assassinated. He gets, again, too big for his boots. But can you tell us what actually happens on the Ides of March?
He had made a lot of... Yes, he had around him a lot of people who he had every reason to think of in the Senate. It were his friends. And there, some of those were people who he'd fought with alongside with him in Gaul and who'd been very close to him and had done stuff with him and who felt that they should be doing well out of his dictatorship. But there were also people who'd been his enemies who he'd pardoned and they felt very guilty and well ashamed about being pardoned. There were people whose wives he'd seduced. There were people whose land he had taken away and given to his mistress. There were people who felt that they should have been more powerful than they were and people who thought they should have been richer than they were. But there was no suggestion, and I don't think in his mind, whatever Shakespeare says, that that they thought they were all going to get up and assassinate him, because it was a very unusual thing. I mean, he was, it wasn't the sort of general killing they were planning, a sort of hole in the corner, running through the sword in a back alley. This was a large group of fellow senators, no longer his equals, but people who felt they were the same class as him, getting together, agreeing in secret that it was the right thing to do, having their daggers somehow with them under their togas, and piling in on him like a rugger scrum in the Senate. And although Rome was a very violent society and lots of the murders happening all the time, not all of them even illegal, nonetheless, this was a joint enterprise assassination by a lot of very grand people against another grand person. It was a big event, and they all piled in on him. He couldn't really defend himself because he didn't have any weapons much other than the pen he was writing with. No one stood up for him, pretty much. Anybody who might have stood up for him that they managed to keep away, mainly particularly Mark Antony, but even very doubtful whether Mark Antony would have stood up for him either. And so he was all on his own in the end, and died in a heap on the Senate floor, and all the senators rushed out, including the conspirators. The conspirators hoped to become great heroes, and everybody would clap and say, well done. But it turned out quite quickly that although a lot of the grand people were quite happy to get rid of Caesar, the poorer people, the voters, particularly the army, weren't. And after that, things started to go pretty badly for the assassin. Though they, over the next 14 years, had plenty of chances where they might have won. But the idea that they would be acclaimed as great heroes from the start was, they lost that right away.
So all these Renaissance paintings of the death of Caesar are more or less what happened.
Yeah, I mean, they all give different takes on it. And of course, their imagination is no better than ours. We have quite a few accounts of what happened. It's an important date in terms of, for History Hack, it's important because we probably know more about what happened on that day from different accounts and different people's interests than we do for another 1,000 years or so. It's people often say, well, how can you possibly know what happened, in Roman history? We've only got so few sources. But in fact, there are many days that we know a lot about what happened, and the day of Caesar's assassination is one of them.
So there were 13 men who took part in this assassination.
Might have been many more than that. A guy, one of the sources, Nicholas of Damascus, says that there were 80, and there was, like, some people say 23, some people say, 43, 19. We don't have that many names. I think it's very possible that even the people involved in the plot didn't know how many people were in it, because Brutus and Cassius have been sounding out people in code rather carefully, not surprisingly. They wanted to see whether they were likely to join the plot. And they couldn't just say, go up to someone in a room and at a party and say, are you up for it? Are you in our plot to kill Caesar? Because someone might have overheard, and there's slaves everywhere, and the slaves might have gone off and told other slaves or told somebody else. So they had to talk in a kind of philosophical code. That's one of the reasons why the philosophy interests me a lot, and it's important to this, because it was by asking them sort of questions about what was the right thing to do in different circumstances. So I bet even at the end, even when the act happened, that Brutus and Cassius didn't know exactly how many people were with them.
So you write about 13 of these men. You've already mentioned Brutus. Most of us know, well, I hope most of us know who Brutus is, and Cassius, actually. But what about some of the others? Can you tell us a little about a few of the other assassins that we know of?
Well, they're a mixed bunch. I mean, they're all people from the upper class, if you like. So the guy I chose, Cassius Parmensis, was probably one of the most obscure, and came from, Parma in the north of, wasn't even in Italy, then. And he was a sort of provincial guy who thought of himself as a bit of a poet and a playwright and a bit of a philosopher. And he's not the old-fashioned chap who comes to, who's in Rome, perhaps not the kind of sharpest knife in the drawer, but, he was one of the ordinary guy. That's why I find his perspective, looking at it through his eyes, so unusual and interesting, and that's something I hadn't done before I began this project. But most of them were grand figures. There was a guy, called Minucius Basilus. He was a pretty nasty work landowner from down in the south of Italy. His sort of habit when his slaves didn't behave properly was to cut off their ears and cut off their noses, and generally was, I suspect, not the nicest person to have for a master if you were a slave.
Sounds like a charmer.
It's a charmer, yeah. He'd fought with Caesar in Gaul and he'd done quite well, but he'd let a big Gallic chieftain off. You know, he could have captured him and then let the guy somehow escape. So Caesar wasn't too pleased with him. And therefore, when he came home and he was expecting to get lots of rewards, you know, the consulship, big jobs, big provincial government, he thought he was going to be a really big man. Caesar didn't really give him what he wanted. And so he was definitely up for killing Caesar. And then there was Tullius Cimber. You know, he was someone who fought against Caesar along with his brother. And Tullius Cimber had been pardoned by Caesar, which made him feel perhaps a bit ashamed. But Caesar hadn't pardoned his brother, who fought for Caesar's enemies for a bit longer. And so he was, you know, angry and upset that his brother hadn't been pardoned. There was a guy called Galba, who was one of the many people who Caesar had an affair with his wife. There was a guy called Pontius Aquila, who was fed up with Caesar because Caesar he refused to stand up and do and sort of honour Caesar like a king when Caesar was beginning to expect to be honoured a bit like a king. And Caesar had noticed this and said, "Well, look, you're not going anywhere while I'm in charge." And so he had plenty of reason to get rid of Caesar. A lot of Cassius, you know, the most famous one in Julius Caesar, the more famous Cassius, who was with Brutus, the co-leader. I mean, he'd had some lions, which he was prepared to, in cages that he was going to put on in the circus in a great show. It would have made him seem a big guy. And Caesar just sort of commandeered these lions and said, "Oh, no, I'll have those lions." Now, all these things sound quite trivial, but in the kind of Roman idea of honour and propriety and what was deserved and what wasn't deserved, whether it was your wife or sort of lions or a job you didn't get, all these were good reasons to adding up to why you might join a plot that had been set up for the honourable reason or sort of seemingly honourable reason of stopping a tyrant turning himself into a king and a hereditary monarch.
I mean, Caesar pissed off a lot of people. I mean, sleeping with someone's wife, I can see that being justified. You slept with my wife, you will die.
Well, Caesar slept with almost everybody's wife, and they weren't perhaps quite as fussy about it as later periods would be. But nonetheless, it was people could take exception to it, and Caesar's mistress is, in as much as we can talk about the love of someone's life in the ancient world, because we're a bit short of information about that, it was called Servilia, and Servilia was Brutus's mother. So one of the key leaders of the assassination was the son of Caesar's favourite mistress. I mean, it was all quite a family affair at the top, both on all sides. And often you get the impression that no one was really taking quite enough notice of what the ordinary people were thinking.
I've got to laugh. So basically Caesar was sleeping with Brutus's. I did not know that. So another one, you slept with my mum, you die.
Well, he didn't sleep. No, Servilia was, according to some people think, was the sort of, he'd been his great love since he was a teenager. Other people say that their affair started a lot later. Servilia was a very, very powerful woman. It's very difficult working through the power and influence of women in ancient Rome, because they're sort of, to a large extent, written out of the story. Just they had to sort of do their working behind the scenes and in secret. But Servilia does pop out. I mean, she chairs some very important meetings after the assassination has taken place. And it's quite clear that when a big guy like Cicero was there, who normally everybody would listen to and say, you know, Cicero this and Cicero that, The person actually in charge of the meeting, who seemed to have the biggest influence on what was would happen or not, was Servilia, Brutus's mother and Caesar's, but then dead Caesar's mistress.
Oh, we're going to do some Cicero bashing a little bit later on. But before we get to a bit of Cicero bashing, after Caesar's assassination, so Mark Antony, another name everybody should know, he summons the Senate, doesn't he? What happens then?
Immediately after the assassination, although the assassins weren't greeted as heroes, it was quite clear to the general senatorial will, if you like, that it would be best if you just pretended that Caesar had never existed. That if they kind of pardoned the assassins and said, well, look, okay, we're not going to punish you. We're not going to praise you too much. We're not going to punish you. Everybody can have the jobs that Caesar had previously given them. Caesar had set the jobs that people were going to have for the next 3 years because he was going off on a big military campaign. So a lot of the top people had a lot to gain from keeping Caesar's so-called actor, the decisions that he'd already made, because they were all going to make a lot of money and get a lot of power out of it. So they did a kind of deal, Mark Antony and Cicero and the assassins did a deal whereby essentially they wouldn't go after the assassins, they wouldn't go and hunt them down, they wouldn't praise them and say they were superheroes, and everybody would get the job that previously Caesar had said he could have. And this seemed like quite a nice arrangement, and people would say, well, Caesar was a bit of a blip, all got a bit out of hand, get rid of Caesar, everything can go back to normal. But unfortunately, Caesar had left a will, and he left his name and his estate, whatever that was, to one of his sisters. He had two sisters, and one of them had a grandson, so not exactly that close a relative, called Octavius. And he was a sort of student. He was like an 18-year-old kid on a sort of student gap year kind of holiday in Greece. And no one much had heard of him. No one really had expected he would play much of a part. He might come home and ask for the money, and they'd give him a bit of money and tell him to go away. And they'd be able to continue with their deal. But Octavius turned out to be a rather remarkable person, certainly a very extraordinary boy. And he came back and he realized very quickly that the soldiers and the people liked the name of Caesar. Caesar was a kind of good brand for them. Caesar had given them food and he'd given them jobs and had brought a lot of money back. And he hadn't actually taken much power from the people. The people still had the quite considerable power that the people had in Rome. It was only the senators who he was sort of taking the power from. So Octavius discovered in quite short order that by saying, I am the new Caesar, everybody would, he could take a lot more than a bit of pocket money from Caesar's piggy bank. And soldiers started going over to him, he came over. And once Octavius was making the argument that I am the new Caesar and these assassins a vile, terrible murderers, poor Mark Antony, in order to stay in the game, didn't have much choice but to do the same thing. So Mark Antony started attacking the assassins and going after them too. So you ended up for a while with a rather complicated sort of four, sometimes sort of five-way battle between two suspicious. Octavian and Mark Antony were pretty suspicious of each other. Various senators were pretty suspicious of each other. And then there were the assassins who were, by then had sort of split and were some in the east and some in the west. So it was a very complicated picture with some very grisly, unpleasant scenes. But basically the idea that if you were on Caesar's side, if you were Caesar's soldier or Caesar's voter, you would support the hunting to the death of each of the assassins who killed Caesar, suddenly became the only show in town, and if you were, you couldn't. You either had to be for that or against it.
It just sounds like a complete and utter mess right now.
Well, it gets a bit simpler. There were lots of different places where the fighting happened, and one of the interesting things about writing a book like this is that I take it, moment by moment, through what was happening at any particular time. So I don't assume, as people do if you look back on it, on events, that everybody knew what was going to happen. And also people had some sort of magic idea of what was happening in all the different places. Ancient warfare and was extremely confusing because the communication was so poor. I mean, and ancient battles were very confusing, and as battles remained very confusing right up until the 19th century. It was very difficult to know anything that wasn't happening just around you, a few yards around you. So there's no point trying to pretend that it's all fantastically simple and there was a good guy and a bad guy, or even one side or another side. There were frequently many sides in many places, out of which almost anything could have happened, and one thing did.
So before we get into the fate of some of these assassins, I thought we'd do a little bit of a discussion about Cicero. I'm going to pretend I like Cicero right now, but he wasn't one of the assassins, but he was a supporter, wasn't he? So how did he actually support the assassination? Why? And what happened to him because of it?
He supported the assassination big time as soon as it had happened. He wrote to the guy I was talking about just now, the guy who used to lock the ears and nose of his slave, Minucius Basilus, and said, you know, wrote him a note saying, "Oh, glorious day, wonderful day, marvellous people, you know, wish I'd been with you." Kind of, you know, he went on a sort of whole scheme of how marvellous the assassins were. Before that, they hadn't really trusted him to be involved in the assassination. I think they probably thought that he was just too clever by half, and any clever argument that you could put for an assassination, Cicero was smart enough, and he was very smart, you know, to put the counter argument as to why it would be a bad idea. So if you said, look, you know, you can't have a decent life under a tyrant, he might have said, well, the other way of looking at it is to say, if you get rid of a tyrant, you'll get civil war, and civil war is even worse than tyranny. And those are the kind of arguments that Cicero was, you know, using Greek and mainly Greek examples, was very good at. So he was probably a bit irritating to people who decided they wanted to kill Caesar. So they didn't involve him in beforehand. He was also a great blabbermouth, and he had a great house with constant sort of gossip parties. And so they probably thought that this plot would stand even less chance of remaining secret if Cicero knew about it. So Cicero only got really excited after the assassination was over. And then he sort of took on the role of trying to sort of be the negotiator. So the deal I was just talking about between the assassins and Mark Antony, to basically pretend that that Caesar had never existed and everybody take their money and run and get the jobs. Cicero was the kind of broker of that. But then Cicero and Antony, Cicero actually had a lot of form going back. Cicero had put to death the husband of Antony's mother when he'd been consul a few years back. And it didn't take long before Cicero took when he saw that Antony, and probably Octavian, but Antony was the more powerful at the beginning, might be trying to become a kind of Caesar himself. He took the side of take the side of the Senate, wanted everything to go back to normal. I'm simplifying here, but the Senate wanted to get everything back to normal, and the assassins, who were pleased to have got rid of Caesar, and he really went for Antony, and he delivered the speeches of the so-called Philippics, were some of the most abusive speeches about an individual, saying what a louse he was, that have ever been delivered in any political forum anywhere. So Cicero and Antony were completely at odds, and Cicero was delighted when it looked one moment when Antony had lost to one of the assassins, Decimus Brutus, up in the north. But then it turned out to be a big mistake, and Antony hadn't lost, he got away. Decimus Brutus was the third assassin to be killed on Antony's orders up in the north, and Antony then was in a position of, you know, considerable power. And when he and Octavian decided that for a while maybe it best if they were on the same side and to deal with the assassins, so Octavian and Antony got together saying, we're on Caesar's side, Cicero was high on the list of the people that they wanted to bring to a nasty end. And Cicero did indeed come to a very nasty end.
We are going to talk about the third assassin, but before we do get to that stage, and by the way, love that the ending that Cicero got, you get what you deserve, in all honesty. So that all the 13 assassins die, we can't cover all of them on this podcast, however much I'd love to sit here for 2 or 3 hours discussing this with you. Let's talk about the first assassin to die. It didn't take long for him to die. Can you tell us what happened to him?
Gaius Trebonius was a soldier of Caesar's, but he was quite an intellectual. In fact, he was a kind of editor, if you like, of bits of Cicero. He produced little books for people who wanted to sound like Cicero but couldn't be in Rome to listen to the whole speeches. So he was kind of considered himself a rather civilized and intellectual soldier, and he got a good job after the. After the Ides of March, because Caesar had promised him before, and he was going to be governor of Asia. And he took the view that he would just scamper off to Asia straight away, get his governorship going, get the tax money coming in, and get rich, which was what they all wanted and needed to do. But he fell foul of a man called Dolabella, a sort of hitman rowdy, who was from a very grand aristocratic family, but had been effectively a bit of an enforcer for Caesar. And he had also, to Cicero's complete annoyance, had married Cicero's daughter, and had been an extremely, I think, rather abusive and extorting son-in-law. So Cicero didn't like Dolabella, but hardly anybody liked Dolabella, but he was a good guy to have on your side in a fight. Dolabella becomes consul after Caesar's death, amazingly, and gets the consulship that Caesar had to give up in order to, was planning to give up in order to go and fight, and gave up instead by dying. So Dolabella becomes consul, and he hairs off to try and take the province of Syria. And on the way, he stops in Smyrna, which is a city in Trebonius's province. And the two of them sort of have a bit of a careful eyeballing, with Trebonius pretty keen on learning the latest gossip about what's happening in Rome, and Dolabella wanting to know where the money was. Dolabella was always broke. So he wanted Caesar's money, he wanted Trebonius's money, and he was also, by then, aligning himself with Mark Antony. And all those three things together meant that he saw the benefit of being the first guy to kill one of the assassins of Julius Caesar. And because he also wanted the money, probably, and wanted to extort some information from Trebonius, he brings in a guy and some soldiers, and a guy called the Sumerian. So the soldiers go into Trebonius' bedroom and say Dolabella wants to see him. And Trebonius says, "Well, I'm not going there." And they say, "Well, your head's going anyway, So they just threaten to sort of cut his head off straight away. And then Dolabella himself comes in with this Sumerian sort of professional arms maker and torturer, who hots up his irons and tightens the rack, and puts poor Trebonius through it for 2 days before they cut Trebonius's head off, and the soldiers sort of kick it around the promenade of Smyrna. Early account of football in the military machine.
I'm so sorry for laughing.
So Trebonius comes to a particularly nasty end. Now, however bad Trebonius's end was, by the time Cicero got to hear about it, it became like sort of 10 times worse. So Cicero did a speech against Mark Antony, attacking Mark Antony through Dolabella, describing the absolute outrage of these two senators, one torturing the other, because it's okay in Rome to torture slaves, and it was, foreigners perhaps, who knows, but for Roman senators to torture each other was definitely beyond, not beyond what was okay. And so one of Cicero's most vicious speeches against Mark Antony was his attack on Dolabella, Antony's man, for killing Trebonius. And Trebonius was the first assassin to die.
I love that. One rule for them, another rule for the others. It's
that's very important. You can't understand ancient history unless you understand that. It's quite difficult sometimes to talk about it now because the things that they did kind of perfectly normally seem so appalling to us. And writing ancient history is like walking a tightrope. You look down on one side of the tightrope and you see people, having affairs with other people's wives and having quarreling over sex and money and power and basically seeming pretty much like us. And then you look down the other side of the tightrope and you find that they, the way they treat their slaves and their attitude to slaves and their attitude to honor and their attitude to their own history is really completely different from ours. And we would often say completely deplorable. But you can't understand the whole of what happened after Caesar's assassination or in any other part of Roman history unless you're prepared to look down on both sides of the tightrope.
So we've briefly spoken about the third assassin. Tell us, how does he meet his end?
Decimus Brutus. He escaped from the big first battles, which were in Parma. Cassius Parmentus's hometown was completely destroyed by Mark Antony's brother. And it was destroyed so badly that Cicero could only he wrote a letter which only two words survive. Miserrimos Parmenses, the poor, wretched people of Parma. They were just completely smashed in this battle. And it went different ways. It was fought in mud and swamp, and there were different armies at different times. Decimus Brutus, who was a powerful commander for Caesar in Gaul and really had seen it all, I think became completely disillusioned and depressed by the whole business. And there was a brief period when he thought he'd won, but it all came to nothing. And he had to escape. He tried to escape, as it were, north over the Alps and cross over to Greece and to join Brutus and Cassius. But when Mark Antony and Octavian got together soon after that, they set up a set of rules by which anybody of the assassins could be just killed without any cause whatsoever. And Decimus Brutus ended up in the hands of a Gallic chieftain. Now, who killed him? I suspect, I don't know, if Decimus Brutus was lucky, he had a quick death at the hands of the Gallic chieftain, but given what Caesar and Decimus Brutus had done to the Gauls, you might think he might not have done.
Okay, we've mentioned the Kimber brothers. There's both of them. They both meet their end together, don't they?
Well, we don't know when, probably. There was a big battle. Once the story of what happened to the assassins after Caesar's death is in various phases, but the period when their highest point was before the so-called Battle of Philippi, the two battles, and that's where a lot of the assassins were killed. And Tilius Kimber was definitely part of the march with Brutus and Cassius to Philippi. He was a bit of a drunk. He used to had a good time on parade and good talker. But when it came to a crunch, he was also a really good guy to have on your side. And he helped them to get into a really good position before the battle. And was important, but he and his brother, I suspect, both died at Philippi.
So there's a nice chunk of your book that is obviously about the last man standing, so the last of the assassins to die. And you mentioned earlier it took 14 years for him to die. I mean, he survived a pretty long time compared to some of the others. What actually happens to him? How does he manage to get and stay alive for 14 years?
Cassius Parmenses kept on joining the side of whoever he thought might defeat Octavian. And although it's was a very important, fascinating, extremely dramatic and thrilling 14 years of history, people tended not to be that interested in it so much, because people were interested in the end of the Republic and fall of Julius Caesar, and they're very interested in the rise of Octavian and in the beginning of the empire, because we had emperors for so many, such a long time, 1,000 years or so after that. So the bit in the middle, you know, becomes a bit a bit obscure, and some of the people who could easily have made a difference just more or less get written out of history altogether. So there's a guy called Sextus Pompeius, for instance, who was the son of Pompey, who Caesar defeated in his first of his civil wars. And he was a really powerful figure. He ruled all of Sicily and huge areas of the coast. He was a big naval commander. And once the Battle of Philippi had been lost on land, Cassius Parmensis, who was in charge of some ships that the assassins were going to use in the next stage, took the ship down and joined Sextus Pompeius. So he was in Sicily, in what was effectively a kind of rival state, in which Octavian couldn't do anything about. And Sextus Pompeius, at various points, might easily have allied with Antony to defeat Octavian, and then maybe he could have defeated Antony because with his navy, and the whole story could have been totally different. So Cassius Parmensis, first was with Brutus and Cassius at sea, and then he was with Sextus Pompeius when he was fighting massive naval battles against Octavian. And then once the biggest of those battles was lost, Cassius Parmensis even, amazingly, joined Mark Antony, who he'd been so opposed to. And so in the final battle, Battle of Actium, as it's called, Cassius Parmensis was then fighting with Antony, his one of his former enemies, against the greatest enemy, Octavian. And then when the Battle of Actium was lost, Cassius Parmensis, he could have gone, tried to go somewhere else. He could have maybe tried to leave the Roman Empire altogether. But in fact, he went and sat in Athens amongst all the other sort of relics of what had been 14 years or more of civil war. And you can imagine sort of a lot of old soldiers there looking back and thinking, what went wrong or what went right, and frankly, was that assassination worth doing altogether? And then Cassius Parmensis was in his, you can imagine, he was in retirement. He had his books, he had his poetry, he was a playwright. He, you know, I don't suppose life was so bad for him, but he must have known that since Octavian had got all the other assassins, including quite recently his best mate, a guy called Turullius, who'd been executed on cost for cutting down a few trees. But not really, but he'd been an assassin too. So it did look as though Octavian was going through the card, and that Cassius Parmensis was the last one. And Cassius Parmensis had these terrible dreams of large, bearded, dishevelled men coming to him at night, and nasty sense of that the spirit world wasn't going his way. And not long after that, a man with a sword came from Octavian, and that was the end of the last assassin.
Wow. I've got to tell you, I really loved your book. Absolutely loved your book.
Thank you.
Talking about all 13 of these men. So I really recommend people to go out there and buy it, because we've just today touched on all the information that is in this book. Like I said, I could sit here for hours listening, but could you tell our listeners exactly where they can get your book and the title of the book, just to remind them?
The book is called The Last Assassin, The Hunt for the Killers of Julius Caesar. And I last went into Waterstones. It was piled up in a table, very visible. So it's got a wonderful picture of a bloody hand against a sort of marble wall. You can buy it on Amazon and on Blackwell's and all good bookshops, as they say. And I hope you read it. People say it's more like a thriller than a history book, and I was delighted to hear that the critics say that it was a good thriller read. Because what more can you ask than that?
I completely agree. I personally couldn't put it down. And I wish we could talk about all the assassins today, because I love talking about ancient history. But I really want to thank you so much for joining us. It was absolutely insightful learning about these 13 men and doing a bit of Cicero bashing, because we love a bit of Cicero bashing on this podcast. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Join us tomorrow when all of my interview dreams come true and I get to spend nearly an hour with Simon Sebag Montefiore talking about the Romanovs. We go from start to finish with the dynasty. We chuckle at some of them and lament some of the others and pick our favourites. So don't miss out on that one. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.